Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, July 27th, 2025. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on the Dragon Bravo fire. Then we'll move to another top story on the Arizona prison in Florence. Then on to Valley and State news and conclude the first hour with news from USA Today in national and world news. So our first article is a feature front page article from the Republic. It's entitled An Unextinguished Legacy. It's by Tom Zollner. Perched at the edge of Grand Canyon's Bright Angel Peninsula, the North Rim Lodge was so perfectly situated and well constructed that it seemed to emerge out of the sandstone itself, like just another geologic feature. Others compared it to a Greek monastery built on a pinnacle, or a medieval fortress impervious to sacking. The aura of permanence and natural rightness held by the North Rim Lodge helped obscure the fact that it was only as old as 1937, a bare blip on a planetary timescale, and also that it was never immune from the forces of the environment that surrounded it. On July 12th, a wildfire sparked by lightning tore through it and burned it to the Kaybob limestone foundations, along with approximately 70 of the nearby tourist cabins and other structures. Few doubt that the North Rim Lodge will be rebuilt. The spot it occupied is too topographically eloquent to surrender for touristic use, plus most of the toughest permitting is already in place. The question is how much the new creation will resemble what was lost. The lodge was never the point of coming to the Grand Canyon. The real purpose lay out beyond it. But as the modest aperture to the human camera, it had a special grace and a dignified beauty of its own. The lodge was designed so that you're funneled into it, then and out of it onto the back patio, directing you into a singular view, said Stephen Pine, an emeritus professor at Arizona State University and the author of the intellectual history, How the Canyon Became Grand. It was a portal into the canyon. It distilled everything. Moreover, it held an expert sense of suspense. Unlike a mountain that can be seen from miles away, the Grand Canyon reveals itself in a shocking visual thunderclap all at once. For those arriving down the long road across the North Kaybob Plateau, the front of the lodge functioned like a curtain, delaying the scenic climax until after the visitor had walked through the front door and through the lobby toward the sunroom and the veranda beyond, where the full explosion of color and depth awaited. The architect Gilbert Stanley Underwood designed the lodge on a contract for the Union Pacific Railroad, which was then seeking to lure wealthy tourists into national parks with the promise of big roaring fireplaces and chilled gin martinis instead of bugs, heat, and canvas tents. A first lodge built in 1927 with an observation tower and a second-story sleeping hall had been partially destroyed in a September 1, 1932 fire started by flying sparks in the kitchen as the chef was preparing breakfast, according to a wire service account. The flames that consumed the dining room and two cabins made an impressive pyre that could be seen clearly from the South Rim, 13 miles across the gorge. Nobody was hurt. The first head of the National Park Service, Stephen Mather, made it clear he wanted an inviting building to replace the old structure. A former reporter for the New York Sun and an advertising man who came up with the first slogans for the detergent called 20 Mule Team Borax, Mather was prone to fits of depression that he helped soothe by trips out into the woods. He believed that easy access to the nation's treasures was a key to civic betterment. And when Theodore Roosevelt named him head of the new Parks Agency, he took tasteful and limited development for the people to be a mission on behalf of democracy. Mather helped rid the Grand Canyon of tacky profiteers like Ralph Cameron, who had gotten rich off rent-seeking tourist traps like Indian Gardens and the hiker's toll booth erected at the top of Bright Angel Trail. In its place, he sought orderly accommodations run by established concessionaires. In those days, that meant the railroads. The South Rim became the exclusive province of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, with its famous chain of Harvey houses. The North Rim went to the Union Pacific, which sought to link it in a round-trip bus circle with other national parks at Zion and Bryce Canyon. The North Rim slows it all down. The novelist and polemicist Edward Abbey, who worked for a season in a North Rim fire tower just a few miles from the lodge, would later complain about windshield tourism and the corporate blandification of America's treasures. But Mather's legacy of tidy clusters of campgrounds, general stores, lodges, and ranger stations prevailed and determined the quotidian side of how national park visitors would experience grandeur, what they would eat, where they would sleep, and what trinkets they would buy. Underwood's North Rim Lodge resembled the other hospitality structures he created for Zion and Bryce. The intimate feeling of a cabin combined with the spaciousness of an art gallery. The centerpiece, called the Sunroom, featured three giant windows that offered a peerless view into the gorge and its colors of salmon, coral, saffron, and blood orange. What made it particularly beguiling was the indirect angle of the Bright Angel Creek drainage and the vast canvas of the buttes and spires below. The eye couldn't rest for long on any one spot. The picture changed by the minute as sun and cloud showered down new shapes and colors on the stone. National Park Service architect Albert H. Good had laid out the government's principle for rustic design in a 1935 manual called, prosaically enough, Park Structures and Facilities. The key paragraph for Western Lodges read, "Successfully handled, it is a style which, through the use of native materials in proper scale, and through the avoidance of rigid straight lines and over-sophistication, gives the feeling of having been executed by pioneer craftsmen with limited hand tools. It thus achieves sympathy with natural surroundings and with the past." The interior walls of the lodge and the oversized trusses emphasize darkened wood, as though the inside were a camera. That at least some of the wood was actually stained concrete and steel didn't seem to register for most visitors, whose attention was purposely guided outside. The understated quality of the design showed off the lodge's greatest virtue. It had the good sense to stand aside with the discretion of a palace valet. "There was something about the antiquity of it," said Craig Childs, author of Grand Canyon, Time Below the Rim. "A flow toward the windows and out the door onto the decks looking down." For the overwhelming majority of visitors to the North Rim, the back patio of the lodge was the Grand Canyon. Surveys indicated that less than 1% of them ventured onto a trail or left the small developed area. Pointing a camera down from the railings amidst the crowds was as close as most ever got. Among connoisseurs of the canyon experience, the North Rim was always the preferred destination. It was a smaller and more rugged experience compared with the more urbanized and commercially packed South Rim, whose signature 1905 El Tovar Hotel had its own design pleasures, including a soaring lobby ceiling, but with a giant flaw. A guest had to cross a street in order to actually see the canyon. Those who went to the North Rim instead, typically just 10% of annual visitors, could fancy themselves more adventuresome. You had to work harder to get there. It is a 3.5-hour drive from Phoenix to the South Rim, as opposed to 5.5 hours to the North Rim, which is also a much farther distance from any interstate and down a 45-mile dead-end road with limited and rustic facilities dangling like a worm on the end of a long fishhook, as opposed to the horizontal Las Vegas strip-line lights of the South Rim, where you could take a passenger train right up to the walls of El Tovar and have a choice of restaurants and junk shops. "The North Rim slows it all down," Child said. "It's not a manic rush. The lodge was built to have you examine the Grand Canyon and take a pause. It was a kind of a cathedral where you were supposed to lower your voice. You were supposed to be diminished. There was a holiness to it that you could feel as you walked in. And in the rivalry between rims, the North could make a better claim on cultural heritage. The relative ease of travel to the South Rim after World War II obscured the fact that the first American period of settlement and development was heavily weighted toward the north side. The explorer John Wesley Powell thought the views from there were superior. In 1873, he took the painter Thomas Moran up to the elevation now known as Powell Plateau, and Moran responded with a magnificent rendering called Chasm of the Colorado, which Congress bought the following year for $10,000. Serenading guests as they depart. From a spot 17 miles west of Bright Angel Peninsula, the Yale-trained geologist Clarence Dutton spent a few weeks in the summer of 1875 surveying the geology below. Though not a particularly religious man, he chose holy names for the spires and buttes that seemed equal to the cosmic array of primal earth force the canyon had opened up. Zoroaster, Shiva, Brahma, Solomon, Buddha, the names speak to gods, heavens, and spirits. His grammatical choices swerved away from Powell, who preferred the local language of the Paiutes and Havasupai for the features he encountered, such as Toraweep Overlook, as well as gritty boatmen's names for difficult spots on the Colorado, like Whirlpool Canyon, Gates of Lodore, and Hell's Half Mile. Some felt that Dutton was acting blasphemously, or at least taking too much literary license. But others thought only a reach into the numinous could express the world historical importance of the canyon, which has no physical equal on the planet. Had the view from the North Rim been experienced by oil painters earlier than the late 19th century, Dutton thought, the entire history of art would have been different. He was also among the first to make a written description of the visual bogglement encountered by the millions of North Rim visitors who would come after him. As we contemplate these objects, we find it impossible to realize their magnitude, Dutton wrote. Not only are we deceived, but we are conscious that we are deceived, and yet we cannot conquer the deception. Underwood's masterpiece on Bright Angel Peninsula replaced not just a burnt-down first attempt at a lodge, but a deluxe campground called Wiley Way, established by the entrepreneur W.W. Wiley on a concession from the U.S. Forest Service. Groups of 25 visitors could rent a large fixed tent for $6 and have access to a central dining facility. The Union Pacific supplied him with a reliable stream of guests from April through October. Then as now, the facility shut down in the winter. Among the guests in those first few years of Underwood's new lodge was the novelist Tom Wolfe, author of Look Homeward, Angel, and of Time and the River. He drank Scotch highballs in the back patio, but, like most visitors, didn't venture down the trail. On the morning of June 25, 1938, he rose at 7:30, ate breakfast in the dining hall, and then was serenaded off on the Union Pacific tour bus by a team of waitresses in a ritual they enacted for every departing load of tourists, the sing-away, usually including the World War I classic, Till We Meet Again. As Wolfe's bus moved north and away toward Utah, he gazed down through the forest and the long-sweeping upland meadows with deer and cattle grazing and the aspen leaves in the bright air. He had more to say in his diary about the lodge and the forest than he did the canyon itself, for which he reserved a single phrase, and glamorous. A setting for the canyon's music and music about the canyon. For those who had to work harder to get to the North Rim Lodge, occasionally in a state of physical exhaustion, its abrupt materialization at the lip of the canyon was like spotting a flag on the border of a friendly country. It was the termination point for those trail runners attempting a difficult 24-mile rim-to-rim journey in a single day from the south. And for hikers on the nearby Arizona Trail, The lodge and the nearby general store were favorite resupply and resting spots. Those who developed the closest relationships with the lodge were those who worked there during the summers, especially the cooks and the wait staff. But the rangers and fire crews also treated it like a clubhouse. Pine spent 15 seasons there as a firefighter, some of them living in an old cabin built by the Civilian Conservation Corps. The lodge was an important part of my time there, he said. It was the main social gathering point. I can't tell you the number of nights we walked there. That's where we would see our girlfriends. Once a year, the crew would dress up and do a formal dinner. His relationship with the North Rim went on for decades. He was married there, his oldest daughter spent 2 seasons working there, and he would turn some of his experiences into a material for his book, Fire, A Brief History. Pine recalled one night sitting on the back veranda with one of his colleagues, Ralph Becker, who would go on to a career as the mayor of Salt Lake City. They didn't say much to each other. I want to just listen to canyon music, Becker said. They could see lightning storms on the southern horizon near San Francisco Peaks, making flashes that partially illuminated the abyss below and the tops of Isis, Shiva, and Brahma temples. It was a soothing place, said Pine, a great scene. That same veranda became a venue for more literal instrumental music in later years when the Park Service invited a community ensemble called Symphony of the Canyons to perform outdoor pops concerts. The customary centerpiece was at least one movement from Faraday Grove's 1931 Grand Canyon Suite, which the composer once described as notes in hieroglyphics that were later transcribed into musical notes. On another occasion, he described waking up to his first view of the canyon. I was spellbound by the silence. But then, as it got lighter and brighter, you could hear the birds chirping and the nature coming to life. All of a sudden, bingo! There was the sun. I could hardly describe it in words. The canyon has never been adequately described in words or music notes. Not even the best paintings or photographs can ever trace its immensity. Only fractions can be glimpsed and never held for long. The canyon's real essence, frustratingly out of reach, it instead functions as a metaphor for many things, depending on who is interpreting. Time, death, God, depth, significance, and insignificance. For many, it comes down to permanence. The rocks at Vishnu Basement are 2 billion years old. The walls of the canyon are exactly the same as they were when first seen by the archaic people of 9,000 years ago. The later Havasupai herders, the 1540 expedition of Garcia Lopez de Cardenas y Figueroa, Powell's Corps of Discovery, and the new individual discoverers who arrive every day in cars and buses and leave almost as fast. Surrounded by drying pines, Lodge was destined to burn. If the canyon tells the story of permanence, the settlements on the rim are the soul of impermanence. Set amidst drying ponderosa pines, the North Rim Lodge was always destined to burn at some point. It was only a question of when the flames would arrive and in what manner. The 2025 destruction was not the result of sparks from a grease fire in the kitchen, but the outgrowth of complicated politics of modern fire suppression policy. When a lightning bolt came down on July 4th and started fire in a spot approximately 5 miles from the lodge, fire managers let it burn. A decision well in line with policies to contain such blazes and let them do the natural work of clearing several seasons' worth of dead wood and undergrowth, reducing the chances for more destructive events in the future. But a week later, what had been named the Dragon Bravo Fire hit a patch of fuel and took on a terrifying character in new gusts of wind, surrounding overwhelmed firefighters on a helipad and heading with unstoppable force to the south. Within 24 hours, the lodge was gone. The only way to have preserved its life in advance preparation would have been to give a harsh defensive clear cut to the pines that surrounded it, taking away the sound of wind through the branches and stripping the lodge of one of its best elements, the illusion of organic emergence. Even as the flames were still licking at the fallen trusses, critics questioned whether Dragon Bravo should have been extinguished immediately out of extreme caution. Yet such blanket decisions to smother everything have historically made future fire seasons even worse. It is conceivable that the load of deadwood stacking on the plateau might have stoked a firestorm in 5 or 10 years that would have killed people in the lodge before there was time to evacuate. An irony of Dragon Bravo, said Pine, is that it was itself contained by the burn scar of a previous fire that stole its possible fuel. The outlet fire in 2000, a prescribed burn that ran out of control, left a wall of aspen to the east that provided a partial barrier to the current fire. But it could not save the small island of development at the end of the plateau. The epitaph for the version of the North Rim Lodge that stood from 1936 to 2025 might well be that humanity will never master the awesome nature that lies outside the picture windows. We could frame it, package it, sell it, and make it as pleasant as possible. But we can never truly have it under our control, or perhaps even fully understand its depths. Leave it as it is. You cannot improve on it, said President Theodore Roosevelt when he made the case in 1903 for preserving the Grand Canyon as a national monument. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. The ever-changing portraits on display in the Sumroon communicated this idea without any words of translation. Among the Grand Canyon's other guiding metaphors is regeneration. Fires have swept through the ponderosas on the rim for as long as the trees have grown. They will keep growing back, fed by new nitrogen in the ash. The river, 6,000 feet beneath the rim, will keep carrying Rocky Mountain snows to the ocean just as it has for 5 million years. The canyon itself remains completely untouched by any flickering temporality on its edges, as feeble as a firefly against Alpha Centauri. Touristic capitalism, too, will reassert itself on the North Rim, even in an era of federal budget slashing. Its return is as certain as the regrowth of aspens. A third version of the lodge will come up on Bright Angel Peninsula before the decade is over, ideally one as understated and timeless-looking as the one just vanished, and with an equal respect for the grandeur it was designed to showcase. And that article was entitled An Unextinguished Legacy, and that was by Tom Zollner. Our next top story from the Republic for this Sunday is entitled New Prison Oversight Office Can't Start Work. This is by Elena Santa Cruz. The creation of an independent oversight office for Arizona prisons was signed into law, but it lacks the necessary funding to begin its work. Senate Bill 1507 was the latest in a series of bills introduced in the legislature over the past several years that pushed for an independent body to serve as a watchdog over the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. Bills introduced to the House and Senate in the past had failed. But this bill, sponsored by Senator Shauna Bolick, Republican of Phoenix, stuck. It passed the legislature with bipartisan support and was signed by Governor Katie Hobbs on July 1st. Senate Bill 1507 establishes an office to monitor prison conditions and assess the corrections department's compliance with federal and state laws regarding the health, safety, welfare, and rehabilitation of incarcerated people. The office will also serve as an information hub for people in prison and their families, investigate complaints, and submit annual reports to elected leaders about Arizona's prisons. The Corrections Department was neutral on the bill, but had concerns that the independent office would duplicate their own work and transparency efforts and confuse the public about who to reach out to, a department representative told lawmakers earlier this year. Criminal justice advocates and lawmakers celebrated the long-awaited creation of the new office, but were concerned and frustrated over the funding roadblock. It wasn't a fight this year to get the vote, said Kara Jansen, who was formerly incarcerated and helped push for the independent office over the years. Janssen is also the head of Dream.org's Empathy Network, a nonpartisan group that advocates for criminal justice reform across the nation. It was more so a fight to get the budget, Janssen said. Bullock accused Hobbs of refusing to allocate a single dollar to the new oversight body. Bullock said in a July 3rd news release that Hobbs was creating the illusion of progress. If she believes in this office, she needs to fund it, Bullock said. I'm calling on her to identify immediate funding, whether from her own office or through reallocation from another agency within her cabinet. This is the least she could do to ensure her signature actually means something. Representative Walt Blackmun, Republican of Snowflake, who introduced a version of the proposal in the House this year, praised the bill being signed into law, but said that without funding, it was just a press release. If the governor truly supports oversight and reform, then she should have backed the resources needed to make this office work, Blackmun said in Bullock's news release. Transparency can't wait, and neither should the funding. The governor's office did not respond to inquiries from the Arizona Republic about funding for the oversight office. Shortly after taking office in 2023, Hobbs established an independent prison oversight commission to investigate and make recommendations on key prison issues and appointed a new director for the prison system, Ryan Thornell. Her executive order to create the commission included some of the same language used in a legislative proposal for an independent oversight committee that was introduced by Blackmun in 2021. Commission members Hobbs handpicked, including Blackmun and Janssen, ended up finding that a volunteer commission was not enough to deliver meaningful oversight work and recommended the creation of a funded and staffed independent office in a November 2023 report. Independent oversight duties: monitor, inform, investigate. Proposals for independent prison oversight did not usually have Republican support in the past, but the recent news of multiple killings and suicides in the prisons may have swayed some lawmakers' views, Janssen said. I think it kind of prompted more inquiry into what's going on there, Janssen said. She said taxpayers spend a great deal of money to house people, but are usually unaware of what goes on inside. Janssen said people she has talked to in prison have told her the conditions were pretty bad. Since I've left, it's gotten a lot worse, which is kind of scary, Janssen said. She was released from prison in 2018, she said. The new independent office was expected to serve not only people in prison, but also their families and representatives, as well as Corrections Department employees and contractors. The bill outlines the office's duties, which include provide information and promote public awareness about the rights of people who are incarcerated, establish a telephone hotline and an online forum for individuals to submit complaints, establish a statewide reporting system to analyze data related to the complaints the office received, inspect each prison at least once every 2 years, submit an annual report to various elected leaders with specific data, such as the number of complaints the office received and resolved, a description of any systemic or specific issues the office found, the number of deaths and overdoses in prisons, the number of people who were transported for medical treatment from prisons, and additional information the office received from the department. Janssen was happiest about the oversight office's secure tip lines, which she said created a safe space for people to ask questions or discuss what was happening inside the prisons. That can be staff, family, it can be through inmates, she said. I think the important thing is that everyone feels comfortable being able to call in without fear of retaliation. Thornell has implemented positive programs and initiatives in the prisons, Janssen said, but based on what she hears, external oversight is still necessary. The Corrections Department cannot police itself, she said. It needs to be a completely independent entity that handles these situations, Janssen said. The Corrections Department did not respond to questions. And that article was entitled "New Prison Oversight Office Can't Start Work." That was by Elena Santa Cruz. We're approximately 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, July 27th, 2025. We're going to move on now to Valiant State News with a section of the paper called Around the State covering county news. We'll start with La Paz. Representative Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona, introduced legislation in the House of Representatives that would require the Secretary of Interior to use 3,400 acres of federal land in La Paz County as the site of renewable energy facilities, according to River City newspapers. Increased energy development benefits Arizonans and the neighborhoods around them, Gosar said. The bill builds upon the La Paz County Land Conveyance Act, another bill introduced by Gosar that was enacted in 2019, according to River City papers. Mojave. A man from Bullhead City died in late July after he was pulled from the Colorado River by Bullhead City Police Department boating officers. 51-year-old Thomas Michael McClooney was pronounced dead after going underwater while rafting with a friend on the river, according to Bullhead City Police. An initial police investigation showed the drowning appeared to be accidental, as McClooney was not reported to have worn a life jacket at the time of his submersion, according to Bullhead City Police. Yavapai. Six pilots in training from the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott earned top 10 finishes in an air race across the nation, according to the Prescott Times. Teams from the school participated in the 2025 Air Race Classic, in which pilots traversed from Fairhope, Alabama, all the way to Spokane, Washington, over 2,400 miles away. The Prescott campus Flyers dubbed themselves the Whiskey Row Racers, a nod to a historic block in downtown Prescott, according to the Times. Coconino. Signs of containment were visible for the Dragon Bravo and White Sage fires burning near the north rim of the Grand Canyon in late July. The Dragon Bravo fire destroyed the historic Grand Canyon Lodge and at least 100 other structures, while the White Sage fire grew to over 50,000, according to state and federal fire officials. Over 1,000 personnel combined were assigned to both fires. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs even visited the area and expressed that she would share her findings of the destructive fire with officials in Washington, D.C. Navajo. Sheriff David Klaus of Navajo County was elected to serve as the president of the Arizona Sheriffs Association, according to a post on Facebook. Klaus advocates on behalf of Arizona sheriffs at the local and state level. Klaus replaced Yavapai County Sheriff David Rhodes, who served as the president for 2 years. La Paz County Sheriff Will Ponce was elected vice president of the association. Apache. The candidates for the title of 2025-26 Miss Navajo were announced in late July, before the competition in September, according to the Navajo Hopi Observer. The candidates are Cora Hubbard from Kinlichi, Arizona, Ariana Tapahe from Fort Defiance, Arizona, Camille Uintilly from Ganado, Arizona, and Tanisha Francis from Fish Point, Arizona. Candidates must demonstrate fluency in Dena Bezad and Navajo culture and customs. The pageant will be held during the Navajo Nation Fair in early September. Pinal. Authorities have identified the woman who died following gunfire from Pinal County Sheriff's deputies near a Fry's grocery store during a chase in Santan Valley. Melissa Mills, 46, of Apache Junction, was committing felony flight before she pulled a handgun from the dashboard and fired at deputies, the sheriff's office said. The deputies returned fire, and she was mortally wounded at the scene, according to the sheriff's office. A sheriff's sergeant tried to do a traffic stop on the car in the area of Gansel Road and Pecan Creek Drive, according to the sheriff's office. But Mills didn't stop, and deputies followed. Pima. Michael Bogan, a biologist at the University of Arizona, likes to visit a little-known part of the Santa Cruz River just north of Tucson in Marana to cool off on summer days. The magical oasis created by that river, however, could disappear with a proposed mega data center, he said. Tucson's reclaimed water is needed for a proposed data center, behind which is Amazon Web Services, according to AZ Luminaria. Amazon Web Services was not immediately available for comment. Many local officials tout the data center as a boon for the economy, but many residents worry about the project's long-term negative impact on Tucson's natural resources. Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz County is considering a primary tax increase of 2.36%, which would raise the primary property taxes to $388.48 to $395.65 on a $100,000 home. The county is also considering a secondary property tax increase of 2.43%, which would raise secondary property taxes on a $100,000 home from $77.64 to $79.53. Cochise. The Cochise County Board of Supervisors chose a location for a new county jail at 203 North Judd Drive. The board adopted the resolution on the new jail location, voting 2-1, with Board Chair Frank Antonori voting in opposition to the motion. He said he wanted more time to gather data before deciding. The county is redoing its election to levy a tax for operating and constructing the jail after a judge said the county disenfranchised thousands by failing to send ballots to inactive voters. Since the county settled the court case and agreed to hold another election, the Arizona Department of Revenue will cease collection of the previous jail tax on July 31st. The language on the upcoming ballot measure eliminates the use of funds for jail operations and reduces the duration of the excise tax from a maximum of 25 to 17 years, a departure from the previous ballot language in the 2023 election. The current jail facility faces serious capacity and infrastructure challenges, the county said in a press release. Graham. Eastern Arizona College welcomed 34 young people from the Boys and Girls Club of the Gila Valley at the college's Discovery Park for a science day. Students participated in a range of interactive science activities, including a demonstration with a Van de Graaff generator to learn about static electricity, and making ultraviolet bead bracelets that respond to sunlight. They also climbed into a Polaris shuttle simulator for a virtual tour of the solar system. Greenlee. Morenci students donated thousands of pairs of shoes to people in need. The Morenci High School Pride Band organized a fundraiser during which they collected 2,675 pairs of shoes for people in other countries who need them the most. The money raised by the shoe collection will go toward their trip to Southern California in March. Yuma. The city of Yuma will unveil a new mural created by students in partnership with Arizona at Work. The project, titled Toonie Hijinks, is a comic-inspired piece featuring cartoon characters racing, tumbling, and zooming through a colorful landscape of waves, greenery, and bursts of action, said the city in a press release. The artwork uses bold colors and skate-themed elements. This is a part of a summer mural program that has produced 30 murals across Yuma over 29 years. Most of the students who participate in the program have no prior experience and spend 2 weeks in intensive art training. Maricopa. County health officials announced the first West Nile virus-related death of the season, which was described as an older adult with underlying health conditions. A total of 17 human cases of West Nile virus were confirmed in Maricopa County so far this year, the Maricopa County Department of Public Health announced in a July 21st news release. In Arizona, mosquito-borne viruses are most likely spread from May through October during the peak of mosquito activity. Monsoon season brings much-needed rain, but it also creates ideal conditions for mosquitoes to breed. That's why it's so important for residents to stay vigilant, use insect repellent, drain standing water, and limit outdoor time during peak mosquito activity, Dr. Nick Staub, the department's chief medical officer, said in the release. Staub reminded residents that the West Nile virus can be serious for older adults and those with existing health conditions. The virus spreads through the bite of an infected mosquito, county health officials said. Gila, tribe mining company partner to combat drought crisis affecting cattle forests. The San Carlos Apache tribe announced a state of emergency due to drought conditions impacting cattle, according to Terry Rambler, chairman of the tribe, in a Facebook post. Drought conditions were actively causing the cattle in the area to die. Native acorn and pine trees were impacted by the drought, according to Rambler. The tribe was coordinating with mining company Freeport McMoRan to help ranchers drill more wells in the area, making water more readily available. And that news from the counties was from a section of the paper entitled Around the State. Our next article is entitled Study, Arizona is Ranked 48th for Public Education. This is by Eric Trevino. Arizona's public education system is among the worst in the country, according to a new analysis. The study by personal finance company WalletHub ranked Arizona's school system 48th in the nation. The state tied with four others, Idaho, Alaska, New Mexico, and Washington, D.C., for the highest dropout rate. The study synthesized data from federal sources, including the U.S. Census Bureau and the Department of Education, as well as the existing U.S. News and World Report ranking and college entrance exam scores from the College Board, among others. Data tied to the quality of the education system, such as graduation rates, SAT and ACT scores, and fourth and eighth grade math and reading scores, accounted for 80% of WalletHub's score. The other 20% of the score is based on metrics related to school safety, including the required number of police officers per school and the presence of violence, drugs, and weapons on school grounds. Access to technology and training for remote learning also contributed to a state safety score. Massachusetts' school system was ranked first overall. New Mexico's was last. And that article is entitled Study, Arizona is Ranked 48th for Public Education, and that was by Eric Trevino. Our next article is entitled Popular Sporting Goods Store Entertainment Venue Nears, and this is by Corinna Vanek. Dick's House of Sport, a retail and entertainment venue created by Dick's Sporting Goods, will open this fall in Glendale, according to media reports. ABC 15 reported the store will open October 17th. It is located near Loop 101 and Maryland Avenue on the west side of the freeway. Dick's Sporting Goods Incorporated bought the site from BYPG Holdings in January 2024 for $10.66 million, according to Maricopa County records. The national retailer has already debuted the concept in Illinois, Minnesota, New York, and Texas. In addition to the store's usual athletic products, it will feature a rock wall, golf hitting bays, and cages to practice baseball, softball, and other sports. The Glendale location will also have an outdoor field and track. House of Sport locations include services for golfers to tune, fit, or regrip clubs and technicians for bicycle repair. Baseball players can also get their gloves steamed and custom shaped or test bats in the Hit Tracks batting cage. That article was entitled Popular Sporting Goods Store Entertainment Venue Nears, and that was by Corinna Vanek. We're going to move on now to national and world news with articles from USA Today, with the first on Israel and the second on a family who self-deported. First article is entitled Israel Resumes Airdrops of Aid. The subtitle is Aims to Ease Gaza Crisis Amid Mounting Pressure. This is by Emily Rose. Israel said it resumed aid airdrops to Gaza on July 26th and was taking several other steps to ease the humanitarian crisis in the Palestinian enclave amid mounting international pressure and warnings from relief agencies of starvation spreading there. The Israeli military said humanitarian corridors would be established for safe movement of United Nations convoys delivering aid to Gazans, and that humanitarian pauses would be implemented in densely populated areas. The announcement came after indirect ceasefire talks in Doha, Qatar, between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas were broken off with no deal in sight. The Israeli military said in a statement that the airdrops would be conducted in coordination with international aid organizations and would include 7 pallets of aid containing flour, sugar, and canned food. Palestinian sources confirmed that aid has begun dropping in northern Gaza. Israel's foreign ministry said the military would apply humanitarian pause in civilian centers and in humanitarian corridors on July 27th. It provided no further details. International aid organizations say mass hunger has now arrived among Gaza's 2.2 million people, with stocks running out after Israel cut off all supplies to the territory in March, then reopened it in May, but with new restrictions. Israel says it has let enough food into Gaza and accuses the United Nations of failing to distribute it. The United Nations says it is operating as effectively as possible under Israeli restrictions. The IDF emphasizes that there is no starvation in the Gaza Strip. This is a false campaign promoted by Hamas, the Israeli military said in its July 26 statement. Responsibility for food distribution to the population in Gaza lies with the UN and international aid organizations. Therefore, the UN and international organizations are expected to improve the effectiveness of aid distribution and to ensure that the aid does not reach Hamas. The Israeli military stressed that despite humanitarian steps, combat operations have not ceased in Gaza. Separately, international activists aboard an aid ship that set sail from Italy en route to Gaza said in a post on X that the vessel had been intercepted. The Israeli Foreign Ministry said on X that naval forces stopped the vessel from illegally entering the maritime zone of the coast of Gaza, that it was being taken to Israeli shores, and all passengers were safe. The UN said July 24th that humanitarian pauses in Gaza would allow the scale-up of humanitarian assistance, and said Israel hadn't provided ample route alternatives for its convoys, which has hindered aid access. Dozens of Gazans have died of malnutrition in the past few weeks, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. On July 23rd, more than 100 aid agencies warned that mass starvation was spreading across the enclave. The military also said July 26th that it had connected a power line to a desalination plant, expected to supply daily water needs for about 900,000 Gazans. Israel launched its assault on Gaza after Hamas-led fighters stormed Israeli towns near the border, killing some 1,200 people and capturing 251 hostages on October 7, 2023. Since then, Israeli forces have killed nearly 60,000 people in Gaza, health officials there say, and reduced much of the enclave to ruins. And that article is entitled, Israel Resumes Airdrops of Aid. And that was by Emily Rose. Our second front page article from USA Today is entitled, We Lost Everything. The subtitle is, Family Faced Difficult Journey as They Self-Deported to Mexico. This is by Diego Ore. As broadcasters declared Donald Trump the next president of the United States, Sonia Coria turned to her husband and asked if they should go home. For 7 months, they'd been living in Glendale, Arizona, sharing a two-bedroom apartment with Coria's aunt and slowly building a life far from the threats and cartel violence that made them flee Mexico. Coria, 25, took odd jobs as a cleaner, and her husband Carlos Leon, also 25, worked as a gardener. Their eldest child, Naomi, 8, was going to a local charter school, making friends and picking up English. In the small, kidney-shaped pool of the condominium building where they lived, she had learned to swim. Little Carlos, 5, was learning to ride a bike. Their neighborhood in western Glendale, a city of some 250,000 people just outside Phoenix, was home to lots of Mexican migrants. Opposite their apartment block was a small butcher, Carniceria Uruapan, named after the town they'd fled in the dangerous Mexican state of Michoacan. Trump's campaign and his victory changed how they felt about living in the United States. They had followed the law, entering the United States at a border crossing and applying for asylum. The application was in process, but they now worried they could lose everything. "We run the risk of them taking away the little we've managed to scrape together," Coria remembers telling her husband that night as election coverage played on the television. Leon nodded and hugged his wife. They began to cry quietly, afraid Carlos and Naomi would hear them as they played on the floor in the bedroom they all shared. The kids had been allowed to stay up late so that Coria and Leon could watch the results come in. The family's account is based on interviews with Leon, Coria, and NGOs that helped them on their return to Mexico. Reuters was not able to verify all details of their journey, but core facts were supported by photos, videos, messages, and customs documents the family shared. As the Trump administration vows to enact the largest deportation operation in American history, authorities have raided workplaces, sent alleged Venezuelan gang members to a notorious prison in El Salvador, and deployed National Guard and active duty Marines to contain anti-government protests in Los Angeles. Beyond the 239,000 people the administration has deported so far, some cuffed and led onto planes, the very public expulsion of migrants has had another effect, triggering tough and complicated decisions in immigrant households across the United States on whether to stay or leave. As they discussed returning to Mexico, Leon sent one condition, that they wait until after Trump took office on January 20th to save up some more money and to see if he proved as hardline on migration as he'd promised. In the end, fear led them to leave before Trump had even been sworn in. Despite high-profile deportations to Guantanamo or El Salvador, the total number of deportations under Trump trails former President Joe Biden's last year in office. Increasingly, persuading migrants to leave of their own accord has become a core strategy. "Self-deportation is safe," reads a DHS flyer on display at immigration courts in the United States. "Leave on your own terms by picking your departure flight." The Trump administration in March launched an app called CBP Home, designed to help people relocate. And in May, Trump unveiled Project Homecoming, a sweeping initiative that offers illegal aliens $1,000 and a free flight to leave. Since then, tens of thousands of illegal aliens self-deported through CBP Home app, a Department of Homeland Security official told Reuters, without giving further details. More than 56,000 Mexicans have voluntarily returned from the United States since Trump returned to the White House, according to Mexican government figures. Figures from last year were unavailable. Left with nothing. On January 19th, Coria, Leon, and the two kids packed what they could fit into their F-150 and drove toward the Mexican border. It was just a three-hour drive. A few weeks before, they had witnessed immigration enforcement detaining the father of a Mexican family living two doors down from them. That, Coria said, had made up their minds. It was a hard decision to leave. They had fled their hometown in February last year after armed men claiming to be members of the notorious Jalisco New Generation cartel began showing up at the avocado farm where Leon was working as a guard, demanding protection money. Leon didn't have the money to pay, and the owner was away. Now they were going back. Uruapan is one of the most violent cities in the world, with an official murder rate of nearly 60 per 100,000 inhabitants. In recent years, organized crime has taken over the area, running or extorting farms and businesses, and killing those who refuse to pay. But the family hoped their savings would make a difference. They had managed to scrape together $5,000, and the plan was to buy land and open an auto repair shop using their pickup truck to help with the business. At 5 p.m. on January 19th, they drew up to the Dennis D. Concini border crossing at Nogales. As they passed Mexican customs, the Mexican National Guard stopped their vehicle and asked for papers, the family said. Leon didn't have the car title, just a temporary permit issued that day, so officials confiscated the truck and threatened to arrest him for vehicle smuggling. The officials also took $5,000, the family's entire savings, for what they called a fine before Leon could go free. With no car and no money, Coria, Leon, Naomi, and Carlos sat on the ground outside customs, surrounded by their remaining possessions: clothing, tools, kitchen utensils, a television, refrigerator, and children's toys. "We lost everything," Coria recalled in tears. "We left with nothing and came back worse off." A spokesperson from Mexico's National Customs Agency declined to comment on the specifics of the Coria case. She said in an email to Reuters that its office acts in strict adherence to the legal framework governing the entry and exit of merchandise, as well as the customs control applicable to persons and vehicles crossing points of entry into the national territory. As the sun began to set, the dry desert air turned cold. The family worried about where to spend the night and how they would reach Michoacán, some 1,250 miles away. They were spotted by Francisco Olachea, a nurse with Voices from the Border, a humanitarian organization that works on both sides of the border. Olachea remembers approaching the crying family outside customs and offering them a hand. They loaded the Coria's belongings onto the NGO's ambulance and a rented pickup paid for by Olachea and another NGO, Salva Vision. That night, Olachea took them to Nana Ministries, a Christian organization in the border town of Nogales. Together, Voices from the Border and Salva Vision raised just over $1,000 to buy the family bus tickets to Michoacán and send some belongings to Sonia Coria's mother's house in black garbage bags. On January 20th, the family returned to Uruapan. The four of them shared a small room with no door in the tin-roofed home belonging to Coria's mother. The couple slept on the floor and the kids shared a bed with no mattress. They later moved into an even smaller room at an aunt's house. Leon eventually found work in a car repair shop. Coria got a job in a Chinese restaurant. The children complain about leaving the United States. Carlos asks for his bike. Naomi is forgetting her English. That article is entitled "We Lost Everything," and that was by Diego Ore. And that concludes this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, July 27th, 2025. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.